You are listening to an entertainment program put together by a company called Financial Ineptitude. Anything said on this show is not an endorsement or professional advice. Would you really want to tell a court of law you were suing us because you thought taking financial advice from two idiots on a podcast put out by Financial Ineptitude was a good idea? Really? Clown hat, smiley face.
Financial Ineptitude presents Two Bulls in a China Shop. You can find our podcast at twobullsinachinashop.com or just search Two Bulls in a China Shop wherever you stream your podcasts.
Hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the China Shop. Get inside and strap yourselves in. We have a rocket ship of an interview ready, queued up for you today. As always, I'm Shopkeeper Dan. With me is Kyle, creator of financialineptitude.com. How are you doing today, Kyle?
I'm doing good. How long have you been sitting on that intro waiting to use that one?
Just popped into my head just now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I
live.
Can tell.
Okay, we'll do it live. Oh, we're excited. We are joined today by none other than Anthony Vecchino.
Vecchino.
Author, investor, and entrepreneur. How are you doing today, Anthony?
I'm doing fantastic. I just gotta say, like, I really appreciate that intro because it went from like bulls, China Shop, rockets, trapping it. I'm like, man, it's going everywhere. We got bulls on a rocket ship.
Fun. Has anyone done that yet?
Yeah. I don't know if I'd recommend this, you know, but let's give it a shot. I mean, if Elon Musk can send his Tesla Roadster into,
orbit,
then we can send.
I just saw a story pop up on that. This is a bit of a digression, but trying to figure out what the Tesla looks like today. And they're picturing basically like a cloud of like particles of like all the paint and rubber and stuff that's deteriorated away. Like the little dude sitting in the seat's probably doing all right, but anything that's plastic or rubber is probably disintegrated by now.
He's in his.
Anybody who finds that car is not going to be able to drive it. Not sure why else he'd send it into space.
Yeah, I mean, the marginal utility of that vehicle. You know, when you drive a car off the lot, it depreciates by, like, what, 30%? And, like, as soon as you shoot it into space, it's, like, depreciated to zero. It's just
exactly.
Bad investment. So. Oh, I mean, I'm trying to bring this full circle back to my listeners being like, this has to do with
this. If you want to invest in something, don't shoot it into space.
Yeah. Space cars. Not a good
one. All right. So what other helpful tips do you have for the new investor?
I blew my payload.
Hey, Anthony, why don't you tell us about yourself and a little bit about your journey?
Sure. I think, to explain my story, you first have to really understand that I have ADHD. Like at a certain point in my life, you might say crippled. It was really hard growing up, and specifically in coming out, I just knew I couldn't cut it in like the corporate world at all. Mm-hmm. Because in college I had like 20 jobs. I got fired from every single one of them. Like it was bad, and I barely passed school in general. Like the only reason that I did pass was because I can test really, really well. So
I know that feeling.
It was problematic though, because like I didn't fit into society's conception of like what it meant to be like a meaningful member of society. So I had to figure out, okay, what's my path through life? Because at that point I was like unfocused, undisciplined, unreliable. I like had bad friendships. Because I was a bad friend, I was a bad employee. Like I was like, what am I doing with my life? I went off and I just pursued like my own thing at that point, which professional rock climbing. Cool, maybe to some people, but realistically, all it meant is that, like, I sleep in the dirt more. No.
I was just digging into that Free Solo documentary that.
Oh yeah,
that
with Alan
Trumbull. Yeah. So if it's anything like that, that looks terrifying to me.
Yeah. No, thank you.
I've done a little bit of that, not the level that Alex did, but I used to hang out with Alex actually quite a bit in like dirtbag lifestyle, and it was cool until I tried to marry this woman, and I went to her parents and I was like, "Can I marry your daughter?" And they looked at me and they're like, what are you going to do to provide for? And I was like, ouch, that's rough. That is not how I expected that conversation to go. But it was a fair question, because at that point, like I was $80,000 in debt. Like I wasn't doing much with my life besides just climbing rocks, which is personally fulfilling, but not really contributing meaningfully to society. So
right. They probably didn't like the answer of, well, I thought you were going to keep doing it.
Yeah, they did not like it. So I was not in parents' like dream son-in-law. But I did get her to agree to a marriage. which was cool until a year later she broke it off. And then suddenly I was really, really in debt. And now I had no place to live because she got the house. So I lived in the back of a van in downtown Oakland, California.
Ooh.
And I was in a really rough place in my life. I had started writing science fiction and fantasy on the back end of that conversation with her parents. Cause I was like, well, what can I do? Well, I can write. I know how to do that. I can tell stories. I'll become a science fiction writer. Cause I thought that's what
you just pick one of the hardest fields to get into and then just do it.
I was like, Stephen King can do it. Why not me?
I love your enthusiasm.
Yeah. I mean, this is the guiding principle of my life is like, just run towards a thing hard enough and long enough and eventually you'll get the thing.
And sooner or later, something's going to stick, right?
Exactly. On a long enough time frame. Like as long as I don't quit, I don't fail. That's my thesis. And it's done me well, but so, you know, I'm living in the back of that van. Things are not going great. I'm writing science fiction and fantasy at this point. It'll be another year until like my first novel. Once that happens, it's like a cascade effect and like the next 11 come in the next 3 years. So I write like 12. It's a slew of writing. But also during that point, what really got me out of that, like that funk, that place in my life where I was homeless and like not really feeling like I was living up to the potential that I thought I had inside of me. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I think we all, like nobody thinks that they're average, right? Like,
no.
You probably
Until
think
you hit 40.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And you're like, oh my God, I've been deluded this whole time.
Yeah.
My parents lied to me. I can't be whatever. I was in that place and a buddy comes to me and he's like, hey, let's build a business. Cause you're a sad, mopey, sad dude living in the back of a van. So we got to change this. Like, why don't we build a business? And I knew nothing about business at that point. But I was like, okay, let's do it. Why not? So we built a high-rise window washing company, which utilized our skills as rock climbers and our network of rock climbing buddies. And I discovered like, oh my God, I really like entrepreneurship and business. And it was like unlocking this part of my psyche with ADHD and like being able to now apply it meaningfully towards a task that meant a lot to me. I was like, this is what I was meant to do. So over the last 15 years or so now, I've just been building businesses one after another. That's In 2019, the thing that I focus on the most these days is a real estate private equity firm called Invictus Capital. And we buy multifamily apartment buildings in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And what makes it unique is that we actually do this by partnering with retail investors. So they invest alongside of us in these deals that we then acquire and operate. I cut short some parts of the story to keep it.
Right.
That's where we are now.
So... the investing in the commercial real estate then. So is it like kind of like Fundrise where you just, you know, buy in a portion of the project and then you just kind of sit back and collect a check?
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking about it. So like what we do is called syndication and really it's just a way of, you know, pooling resources between it. Crowdfunding sites like Fundrise is a good example. That's exactly what's happening there. Mm-hmm. When you go and invest in that, you're a limited partner. You're just putting money in and then the general partners are doing all the work. It's exactly that, except for we don't use Fundrise because we just go directly to our investor network and they invest directly with reduces fees that Fundrise would charge, which is great for us and it's great for us.
Are you only in the Minneapolis area or do you branch out to other locations?
Yeah, so we focus only in the Twin Cities. And the reason for that is we're vertically integrated. So with that, we have an in-house property management company. So we don't just raise capital and deploy capital. We actually go buy these buildings and then we operate them ourselves. Our team is dealing with our residents every single day, leasing and maintenance. And so we're kind of a one-stop shop, but that limits us geographically. Mm-hmm. But it's also our competitive advantage because it's our backyard. So we know this market really well and we love it.
That's one of the things that I didn't like about owning property. I still have one house in Mississippi that I rent out, but have to go through a property management firm because I don't live there. So it's kind of hard to, you know, pop in, fix a couple roof tiles and call it a day. Like, no, that's a, you know, 12-hour trip.
Yeah, it's a little much. And like when you have to outsource, you know, our thesis, and this is one of the theses that, or thesi, whatever you say.
Theses.
One of our core theses is whoever's closest to the consumer wins.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we did this. We built a manufacturing company that dealt with polyurethanes. And what made that company unique is that we were the first in the industry to go direct to consumer. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, like, And then also to cut out all supply chain logistics middlemen. And so we took that same concept here, which is like, we don't want to be reliant on property management companies outside of our control, because it just, they never care about the product as much as you do. And at the end of the day, like if you take care of the residents take care of the building, and that takes care of the investment. That's
It's hard to find a good one that, like you said, that you can build a rapport with and mm-hmm. that cares about your product or your property. Nothing worse than having a tenant move out after 2 years and then getting a $6,000 bill as you have to go replace everything.
Yeah. And it makes sense. Like there's no hating on the third party property management companies, but just the way that they get paid, right? Like they get paid on fees. It's very marginal. They get very little money to do all the work nobody really likes to do, like all the thankless work.
Right. So, and then you're still paying for all the repairs and everything else you got to do on top of that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Really what you're paying for is trying to get somebody who knows how to screen tenants.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's the way I look at it. Yeah, back to the ADHD and then being able, like, how'd you act? Was it just finding something that actually, like, you know, piqued your interest, or did you have to do anything else to kind of get through that or over that hump?
No, the interesting thing about people with ADHD is, like, there's a common misconception. People think that it means that we can't focus, but it's that we can't control always what we're focused on. But when we are focused on things, like when we're really passionate or we become obsessed with it, and we go into what's known as a hyper-focused state, which is like the kissing cousin of the flow state, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like this deep obsessive state. And that can be for video games. It could be for porn. It could be for business, right? Like, just depends on what we put that attention towards. Is it moving us forward towards where we want to be? Is it not, right? And for me, so much of my life struggle was I couldn't figure out how to take my attention, my focus, and put it towards the things that were going to move me forward mm-hmm. and not move me laterally or backwards, right? And I think that's the problem that a lot of people get into. So for me, it was starting to create the structures and the habits, the routines in my life that give me the highest percentage chance of spontaneously focusing on the things that were going to be. And I think it's Jocko Willink. He talks about like discipline is freedom. It took me a long time to figure that out on my own, which is, by creating structure and routine, like you have the ability then to go and manifest your greatness within those like time blocks. But for me, like when I was young, I was on Ritalin until I was 16, and it made me feel trapped in my body. It made me feel like a zombie. Mm. And so I went off that drug and I was like, I'm never doing drugs again. I never want to feel like that. I never want to feel. I want to be free. And so I like always rebelled against any type of external accountability.
Right.
And the problem for me was like, I even rebelled against internal accountability. Yeah. So, like, I would set my schedule and I'd be like, screw you, Anthony, you can't tell me what to do. And I wouldn't do it.
Speaking my language here, Anthony.
I get it, man. And so it's like, at the end of the day, discipline beats motivation. And the real turning point in my life was understanding that conceptually, but then being able to apply it practically and saying, okay, we need to build the muscle. Something I think, even if you don't have ADHD, is a skill worth acquiring.
Yeah, I don't think I have ADHD, but I definitely have a discipline issue. So any tips on how to acquire that?
I think the first thing somebody says this phrase, I think it was Naval Ravikant, that self-esteem is the reputation that you have with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When we make promises to ourselves and we don't keep those promises, like what does that say about the reputation that you're forging with yourself? If you were to make promises to your spouse or to your friends or your coworkers or your employees, and you constantly like did not follow through on that thing that you said you were going to do, you would very quickly establish a relationship with those people of like, he can't be relied on. Right. I can't trust him to like, his promises mean nothing. And yet like, we do this with ourselves constantly. We say, oh, I'm going to go to the gym this many times a week. I'm going to start losing weight. I'm going to be a better, more present father. I'm not a father, so I don't want to say
that. I'm assuming that's what fathers
still
say.
Be better at it.
Worry about it. Yeah. but if you make these promises to yourself of these goals or these things that you say you're going to do, but then don't follow through with it, like you are just casting another vote for I'm an unreliable person. Right. So I think that's step one, is to like get really brutal and honest about like being self-aware and saying, am I actually living up to the reputation that I want to have for myself? Is this the type of person that I want to be? The type of person who says like, I'm going to do this, but then doesn't do it. So I think that's step one. Step two, more practically speaking, like the best thing I ever learned or figured out for myself was two things of like creating routines and trying to like habitualize as much in my life as possible. I think there's a guy in the 20s, I can't remember his name. He said that civilization progresses based on the number of tasks that we can do subconsciously or without thinking, right? Like, so if you think about it, like it used to take a whole lot of energy and mental bandwidth to, you know, go from New York to LA when we're riding on a horse and buggy, right? Now we can be on a plane. It's like, I don't even have to think about this anymore, right? So civilization progresses based on the number of activities that we can do subconsciously or just unconsciously. And that's what habits really allowed me to do. Like figuring out, okay, what are the things that I need to habitualize? How do I create routines around that and then guard that time? And the best tactic I have for guarding that time is time blocking, which is just intentional sitting down and saying, if I could map out my perfect day, what would it look like? And then schedule it and then do it, right? Like it seems so simple, but that really is.
It sounds simple, but when you try to do something like that, especially when you have issues already with, you know, wanting to rebel from structure, that's no small task.
It's not. Yeah. And remember, simple is not easy necessarily.
Right.
And I hate to say this, you know, but there is no easy solution here. Like, and I think everybody, like we get into this, what is the quick hit? What is that I can utilize to like hack my system? And all roads to Nirvana, but that road is paved in hard work.
Right.
Like, there's no other way around it.
Yeah, you're just going to have to climb the hill one way or the other.
Yeah, and you hear people talk about like, you need to tie, like, I think Nietzsche says like, the man with the strong enough why can endure anyhow. Like, I do believe there's a lot of power in that. Mm-hmm. I've, you know, like if you can tie what you're doing in your life to a larger sense of meaning, it becomes much easier to self.
All right. Yeah. So that's all you have to do, Dan.
Let's block
off some time and let's work
done. All right. Hold on. Let me schedule my day tomorrow.
I want to know, this is going to be jumping back in time a little bit. You managed to get published writing sci-fi. So you actually are a pretty good author then?
I don't know if I'm pretty good, but somebody, you know, like people bought my stuff. So that was pretty neat.
That's
like,
good. I would say that's good.
Yeah. That's fascinating. Yeah.
You know, it is pretty cool. The science fiction and fantasy, like I went pretty deep in that world and I loved it. But what I started to discover was that writing stories about robots and things like aliens and things that go boom, like that's a lot of fun. I couldn't tie it to a larger purpose in life.
Mm-hmm.
Because like it's at the end of the day, it's entertainment or it's escapism and it's creating an emotional experience for the person reading it, but it's not fundamentally changing their life. And right. I wanted to do something, my writing that was had more potential for impact, that somebody could read the thing and go, oh my God, this, I can imply this and it can change. So we wrote, you know, Passive Investing Made Simple, which is a book about investing specifically in real estate. And that was cool. It hit number one on Amazon. It's been sitting like top 10 for a long time in commercial real estate. That's pretty neat. Like,
and that's the one you're offering to just give away?
Yeah. If you guys, if your listeners, if anybody out there wants to learn about how to, you know, passive invest in commercial real estate, which I recommend, obviously I'm very biased. Yeah, right. Shoot me an email, anthony@invictusmultifamily.com, and I'll send you a free copy of the book.
I'll make sure I put that in the episode description.
Well, thank you. That's I'm going to get a free copy. I'm going to send an email.
Yeah. I mean, that is quite the journey that you've been through then. So, you know, rock climber, writer, commercial real estate investor, and somewhere in there, high rise window washer too. Are we leaving anything else off? I think you also do a podcast too.
Yeah. A couple. So if you're not interested in reading, but you want to learn about multifamily investing and what we do, then we have a podcast, Multifamily Investing Made Simple. My founding partner, Dan and I, we have a lot of fun.
You guys have a lot of fun too.
So
it's not about Dan's making good hosts. Huh?
You know, my Dan's, I don't know if he's as good as your Dan.
Oh shit. Thank you.
Is your Dan the serious one?
Yeah, he's the numbers guy. He brings like the spreadsheets, and I'm like, Dan, this is a podcast. People can't see those.
that's me looking at stock charts. Oh, I think this looks like it's gonna go.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I have another podcast that I do with Austin Linney, which is called The Brain Dump. It's all about the psychology of success, which is like for me, and you guys maybe can resonate with parts of this story, is that for a lot of my life, I tied my self-worth to the act of achieving. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's the dichotomy between the science of achievement and the art of fulfillment. And, you know, fulfillment implies like, hey, if you're not fulfilled, then there's a hole in you. You're not filled, right? And the mistake that I think we as high achievers or, you know, people that are living can fall into is like, we think that we can substitute achievement for fulfillment. So if I can just go get that gold, that blue ribbon, gold ribbon, they don't give gold ribbons, but like gold medal.
Right.
If I can just go get that achievement, if I can build that business, if I can get the seven figures, if I can, you know, write that book, like then I'll be fulfilled, right? Mm-hmm. And the problem is like achievement is a science. I can teach you how to build a business. I can teach you how to write a book. And if you follow the steps, you will do the thing. So it can be formulaic, whereas fulfillment is so individual. It's an art. Like what fulfills you is going to be different than what fulfills me. And for so much, I was trying to fill the hole with achievements and they're fundamentally different mediums. Like if you think about fulfillment, like a road of asphalt, and then you think of achievement as a bowl of noodles, the bowl of noodles put into the pothole does fill the hole, but kind of. Does not like stop you from getting a flat tire, right? Like it's still a pothole. It just has noodles in it now, right? And that was going to take that. That was the issue that I was running into. I was like, how do I live a life of fulfillment? Well, I'll just go and achieve things. And I was like, now I feel empty, but I have all these blue ribbons. Cool. Like now what do I do?
So what's, what are you getting your fulfillment from now then?
It's about tying things to like that deeper meaning and purpose. Like I said, when I was writing science fiction and fantasy, I was like, you know, getting these accolades and like making good money, but it didn't tie to something internally that felt like I was making the impact on the world that I could. And that's really what real estate investing was for me. Cause at that point in my life, like I had built and exited multiple businesses and was doing very fine on my own, but I had a mentor who said something that was really profound at the time. And, is like super cliche, but responsibility is the price of freedom. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really compelling of like, okay, what is, if I want to be free, what's that mean to the people around me, to the society? Like, what's my obligation? What's my responsibility to that? And then he also said like, you do the world no favors by playing small, which we've heard that one before, but like those two things in conjunction had me starting approaching the act of building business a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. Before it was just a fun exercise to see like, can I stack these Legos together and build something really cool? Right. But then it became, okay, well, can these be vehicles for impact? Can they be vehicles for change? And real estate for me was that, because I look at it and I say, well, so many people's lives are affected by real estate.
Yep.
It, whether you're renting or you're going into the grocery store, you know, or you buying your first house, like everybody has some kind of relationship with real estate. And there was a time in my life when I was living in the back of the van. And I did not have a good relationship with real estate. I really wanted to, but I could not. And it was very stressful as a result. And so I was like looking at that. And then I looked at the other part of my life that I was really stressed out, and that was finance. I was like super in debt at one point. And so I was like, okay, how can I marry these two? Like helping real estate, like how can I make an impact on renters and people who are like in that position that I was, which is like workforce housing. You know, they don't have a ton of money, but they want a home that they can call their own.
Right.
And then also like the finances of like, what am I doing with my money? The hell, like nobody taught me what to do in school. Like I'm an idiot and I'm super in debt, but I have a degree that I'm not using. So real estate really was for me a way of like marrying these two things. Cause I have six sisters and two brothers and they're all idiots with money, just like I was. So I was like, okay, if I can do something to help you guys do better, you know, then I'm going to do it. And that's what real estate was initially. And then it just continued to grow to the point. Looking broadly, it was like, okay, well, there's a whole world of investors out there who are just as lost or just as hungry or, you know, just as deserving, you know, these investment opportunities. They shouldn't just be reserved for super wealthy people. So,
Don't even get me started on that accredited investor bullshit.
They're trying to make it harder.
Yeah, I know.
I did a podcast on that and I'm like, this doesn't make sense, guys. I'm so confused.
I've been watching this Theranos trial and watching all these fucking people that invested in something. They're rich. They didn't do any diligence. Like,
yeah.
What is it about having money that suddenly makes you better at utilizing it? Like, no, that's bullshit.
Yeah. And on the flip side, and for the listeners who don't understand this rabbit hole that we're going into, but like the difference between accredited and non-accredited, the SEC says if you make over $200,000 a year or have a net worth over $1 million, then you are a god of investing. You can invest in whatever you want. But if you make less than that, or you have less than that, then God forbid that you're allowed to make your own investment decisions. They need to protect you.
Yes.
If you want to go to Vegas this weekend and blow your life savings, go for it. Yep. So it's like, come on,
guys. Put it all on a spin of the roulette wheel.
Yeah.
No one's going to stop you.
So you couldn't have invested in Uber, you know, in the angel, but you can go play blackjack. It's like, right. Come on, guys.
This you is can buy lottery tickets.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They encourage you to.
Buy some lotto tickets. Don't buy Uber.
You don't know how to invest properly. Buy these lottery tickets. That's good enough for you.
Yeah. So invest in space cars. And buy lottery tickets. I think that's the takeaways here.
Show notes. Good Lord. Way to space bring car. That back. Oh, that was worth the 30 minutes that they're going to have to wait.
Yeah. Well done.
There's like listeners who like stayed with us this entire time. Yeah. Well done. That's your gold ticket.
Dan, do you have anything else you want to ask about ADHD or any of that before I pivot into real estate?
No, I mean, I think he covered pretty much the basics. My journey sounded very, 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 very similar.
I was just curious if you managed to take notes.
Take notes. See, I have a recording of it. Why am I going to take notes?
Yeah, are you taking notes? Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, good point. All right. Yeah, let's dive into a little bit about real estate then, a little bit more. One of the things that's, well, obviously with the housing prices going through the roof after the COVID, I think we saw a lot of people moving out from cities into suburbs. It seems like we've started to see what looks to be another bubble starting to form. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that as far as the real estate market as a whole today.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think real estate's such a broad category. There's so many different asset types, right? So a lot of times when people think of real estate as being risky, they'll think of like 2007, 2008, the financial crisis, and be like, yeah, real estate's risky. Look at what happened, right? But that was really like largely an effect for single family homes, right? Where we saw just massive foreclosures. We saw things going underwater constantly. But then if you look at commercial real estate, the way that the loans are valued and issued, it's fundamentally different. So it's on an income-based approach, right? So it's looking at the business and saying, okay, is there how much cash flow is coming off of this thing? So banks are lending based off of that, the DSCR, which is just the debt service coverage ratio. And what they're asking is like, okay, is this business creating enough cash flow on a monthly basis to cover the debt service and then also the expense ratio? Sweet. Mm-hmm. All right. So that's on one hand, when we talk about like the bubble, I don't necessarily see it on that front. Right now, the banks are still loaning, you know, with pretty tight margins on, you know, loan to value at 75% to 80%. You're not going to see too much more than that. You're still seeing healthy DSCRs around 1.2 or 1.25. So I don't think that there's necessarily a bubble forming there. I think the issue is that there's just so much liquidity in the market right now, right? That people can afford to pay a lot and debt is still so cheap. Yeah, I know interest rates are going up, but it's still like historically low. Well, so yeah. You know, people are able to pay these higher valuations. And I do think it will create this environment where the yield will be less. Like what these properties and these assets will ultimately generate as a return will be less. But in an environment where, I mean, where else are you going to go to get that yield? Like it's still better than the alternative in a lot of ways, right? So it's a good question to always be asking, like, are we on a bubble? But the thing that's really interesting is like ever since like 2016, everybody's been saying like, oh, real estate's on a bubble. Like we're in a bubble, like it's got to pop and the bubble just keeps getting
right.
Yeah. And that doesn't mean like trees grow to the sky, right? Like eventually things correct. You know, I don't necessarily think that we're there though, based off of what we're seeing. Like we're seeing all-time high valuations and purchase prices.
But how much of that is because of shortages?
Exactly. And it's ultimately a supply-demand issue. If you look like from 2010 through 2016, 2012, actually currently, like we as a country, just from a development standpoint, did not build enough new stuff. Mm-hmm. Like we just stopped building things because nobody could come up with the money. Nobody wanted to build. It was a bad time. And so there's this huge shortage of supply versus the demand. And until we get that rectified, which even with really optimistic, you know, projections, like we're not going to be able to get on the right side of that for another decade. Oh, wow. And And we're still like, honestly, that's with really optimistic projections, because like we're not building enough currently to satisfy the demand. And so whenever you get the supply demand disequilibrium, that's great for an investor, problematic for the consumer, because while we're seeing like rental prices and valuations go up, we're not seeing a commensurate rise in income.
Right.
And so what ends up happening is the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. Right. The gap between the two just continues to extend. So those who have assets do great. Those who can't afford to get into assets don't do great.
And typically the assets like, price them out too, the more it goes.
Exactly.
It just makes it harder and harder.
Yeah. And historically, the types of assets that we acquire, like institutional grade commercial real estate, like your mom and pop Joe, like the teacher, could not buy this thing. He could not invest in this thing. Right.
I almost bought a fourplex once. And then I end up backing out because there's just going to be too much to fix some of the structural issues. But even that was, I think that's at the max end of what you can do is to not have to get a commercial loan.
Exactly. Once it goes five units and above, it's commercial. And that scares a lot of people. They don't understand it, which just, again, exacerbates the issue. To your question, are we in a bubble? I don't see it. Mm-hmm. I personally don't see it because I don't see the bank lending restrictions in a place of weakness at the moment. So, but again, guys, I'm really biased. So take
me. Right. Well, of course. Right. how do you think the raising of interest rates is going to affect the markets going forward?
That's a good question. I don't know.
That's a good answer.
You guys consume any Howard Marks?
What's that?
Howard Marks.
Don't think so. Is that a podcast?
Yeah, no. So Howard Marks, he's like this legendary investor from Oak Tree Capital. He wrote a book, The Most Important Thing, and then another one called about market cycles. Just a fantastic, he's like a Warren Buffett type, old guy, really smart. And he's been issuing memos for the last 25 years, like, and they're all free on his website, oaktree.com. One of the best resources ever for investment advice.
Are you thinking I'm pulling my questions from there?
He just recently shared a memo where he's like, listen, like, when it comes to like projecting the future and macroeconomic trends, he's like, I don't know. Like nobody knows. Like, here's my best guess. Like, but we got to prepare for all contingencies. So all that's to say is I don't know. But as interest rates rise, what is interesting is there's always been this thesis, or this, not a thesis, I guess it's been like this assumption, conclusion that interest rates and cap rates are correlated, right? So cap rate is a, you know, capitalization rate, just a multiplier effect in real estate in particular, where we take like the net operating income, so the amount of cash flow this thing's generating, divided by that multiplier, that cap rate, and that gives you the building value, right? So that's a really oversimplified way of looking at it. But what we're seeing is interest rates are rising, cap rates continue to go down. So usually those two things would not happen. They would go together. And what we're seeing is there's just so much liquidity in the marketplace that it's like broken this fundamental connection between these two items that everybody always assumed are like linked, right? So despite interest rates going up, because as interest rates go up, we can afford to pay less for a building, right? Because our debt service is so much more. And so you would say, okay, well, as the debt service or the interest rate goes up, we can afford to pay less, and yet people are still paying more. It's like, well, how is this possible? And the answer is like, there's just a lot of money in the system right now. And how that all plays out, because like, again, like the last 2 years have just been crazy money printing bonkers time. So who knows how this all plays out? And anybody that has like anybody that has a firm stance that they're willing to get on a soapbox and profess, I would run from that person because they don't.
Yeah, nobody knows. What's that saying about the market? The market room remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent.
I like that.
Yeah. I think that was from The Big Short. Yeah, that's one of my favorite quotes. So when you say commercial real estate, are you talking about like apartment buildings or?
Yeah. So between our portfolio is like, I don't know, 40 million of worth of like 20 to 100 unit complexes. We like that space a lot.
And what kind of return are you typically getting on that investment?
So for limited partners coming into a deal, we underwrite for a base 15% IRR. Mm-hmm. All of our deals at this point, we've had multiple go full cycle, have delivered north of 20%. But we don't like, we're the type, we really don't want people pegging expectations to 20%.
No, no.
We're like, down to 15. These deals are structured in a way that they have a preferred return. On our deals, we usually do a 7% preferred return. And that just simply means limited partners collect a minimum 7% return before we, the general partners, get to share in the profits. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean it's not a guaranteed return. Doesn't mean that you're going to get that. It just means
you're first in line.
You're going to get that. Yeah. But yeah, 15% is where we like to peg expectations.
It's not very often a retail investor gets to be first in line to be paid.
Nope.
So how small of a retail investor can get involved in some of these deals?
Yeah. So that's the thing, right? And this is where it gets harder for retail investors, is that the minimum investment amount for us is 50,000. Mm-hmm. Other groups that might be different, right? It might be less, might be more. The industry standard is about 50,000. And that's still problematic for like retail investors who maybe don't have just 50,000 sitting around. But mm-hmm. what a lot of people don't realize is that you can utilize retirement funds. So if you have like an old 401k with a previous employer or an IRA, you can put that into a self-directed account and then invest into these vehicles. And so that's what a lot of our investors do. They've been, you know, teachers or, you know, firefighters for a long time. And they're like, oh, I got money sitting in my retirement account and I want to diversify that. So it's not all sitting in the stock market. So they'll invest in these deals as well.
How do you do that? That sounds actually very interesting.
Yeah. So the self-directed IRA is actually really awesome. So if you have like a 401k with a current employer, you're probably not going to be able to do it because the whoever's overseeing the plan probably won't let you do it. But if you have a previous 401k with an old employer, like you get to decide what it does, right? So you can put it into a new account called a self-directed IRA. We work with a company called Advanta. They've been great. They're just really good customer service. We don't get any benefits out of this, by the way, like get any kickbacks or anything. But it's just like my girlfriend, like she set up an account and she had a 403B. She's a teacher. So she moved all of her funds into a self-directed. And now what you can do with the self-directed is you can invest it into anything that you want. Like you can invest it into crypto. You can go into gold. You could invest into alpacas if you want to, if you think that's a good thesis, you could.
Make some good fur.
Yeah. The main thing is like, they do actually. that woman I tried to marry once, her parents had an alpaca farm. So.
Oh yeah.
Oh, and they were questioning how you were going to provide. I'll raise emus.
But what's really interesting about the self-directed IRA is like, setting it up is super easy. It's like a piece of paper, and then the ongoing fee is like super nominal, like maybe $100 a year or something like that. Then you have the ability to invest it into all different types of things. There are some rules about what you can invest into. Like you can't invest into your own deal, right? Like there are some arm's length transactional things going on there. But that's just one of the things that most people don't realize, that like they actually have more control over their retirement funds than they think they do.
Yeah, I've actually moved a few of mine out into my TD Ameritrade account so that way I could invest them in, you know, stocks or whatever I saw fit.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize you could do basically venture capitalism and the commercial real estate through that.
Yeah, that's huge. Yep.
You know, I actually have a self-directed IRA that I use to angel invest. So tech startups, right? Like
really?
It's amazing. And like there was this whole hullabaloo last year where like the Congress and they were like, oh, we're going to get rid of the self-directed IRA because Peter Thiel did this exact thing where, you know, he held his ownership shares in PayPal and then suddenly it's worth billions. And that's really not what it was intended for. But like, so they wanted to throw the baby out with the bathwater and just take away the whole thing. They're like, no. Like nobody gets to do this if Peter does it. thankfully, that got shot down because it would have created it. Just again, it would have just screwed over the non-accredited investors, like the retail investors on Main Street.
Yeah, you'd think they didn't vote or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
right. Like, how can there be so many of us and we still get fucked at every turn?
Gerrymandering.
There's a term I haven't heard since high school.
Right. Yeah. If only I knew in high school just like how important that term was going to play out in my life.
Right. Ranked choice voting. Woo!
They do that in like most of the civilized world.
It's because it's like how you would handle a giant population voting on representatives. It's just the most easy way.
Now we've got, what is it? The Congress or no. What is the voting thing?
Electoral college?
Electoral college?
Electoral college.
Yeah.
I'm exactly. Mistake. Just the worst system in the world. Now we're getting political.
Yeah. Ooh, yeah. Stepping on landmines. Quick, Dan, ask a real estate question.
I'll go back and I'll bleep every time we say voting, and then people won't know what we're talking about.
Oh, perfect. That'll be hilarious.
People will be so confused.
You know it's filthy if those fuckers bleeped it.
looking at some of the projects that you have on your website right now, Duluth, Grand and Goodrich. These are pretty nice buildings, it look like.
Thank you. I made them better. And that's like what we do is called value add with my family. So we go buy buildings that for whatever reason they're not performing as well as they could, and we go better.
So do you go in and modernize them then, or do you just
do we what?
Like, what do you mean by that? Are you like going in and like modernizing them? Like,
yeah, in a lot of cases,
the appliances, putting tile exactly. in.
Yep. Refreshing the units, making them nicer, putting in some nice laminate floors, better countertops, better cabinets, appliances, fixtures, just generally making a better living environment.
And how long does it typically take until you get your payback on these? Like for you as the investor?
So we buy assets that are cash flowing from day one. So what that means is, so there's a couple of different ways that people are collecting money throughout the life of the deal. Mm-hmm. There's quarterly cash flow distributions. And we buy assets that are already stabilized and performing to a certain level. Like that's mm-hmm. that's one of the things that we really look for. But we're looking for assets then that we can go and improve. So they're doing good, but we can do better. We can do gooder. So usually what this looks like is we'll go through the renovation reposition phase, and that'll take about 2 to 3 years. And then we'll do a refinance. So, you know, we'll go in there, we'll make all these improvements, we'll increase the NOI, which is just, again, the cash flow, which is an important number because that's the number that the bank is going to value the building based off of. So the more cash flow, more profitable we can make the business, the more valuable it's going to be in the eyes of the bank. Then when we go do a refinance, we put on a new loan, we pull out all the initial equity, and now we're right. you know, just playing with house money at that point.
And then what do you, I mean, what's the end goal with these properties that you're acquiring? Are you trying to just hold them and just continuously building a bigger portfolio, or are you ever flipping these?
So it depends. And again, this is like in this industry, it's going to be different depending on the operators. For us, we project a 5 to 7 year hold, with the idea being in 5 to 7 years, we're going to have done all the work, we're going to squeeze the juice, and we're going to sell it. And that's going to be where we're going to get the optimum IRR. In reality, what we talk with our investors about is like we and talking with all the old people that are still around in real estate, mm-hmm. the thing that they always regret is selling. They're like, I just right. wish I hadn't sold, right? And so we talk with our investors and say, yeah, if I still owned Manhattan, I wish
yeah. you got to delete the Zillow account whenever you sell a house. I've
exactly.
noticed.
Exactly. Because you're just like constantly like, I made a bad decision. And so we talk to our investors and say, listen, we project 5 to 7 years so that you can get an idea of like what the IRR expectation is, because we have to have an exit event to calculate that. Mm-hmm. But realistically, if it makes sense and we've pulled out all of our initial capital and we're holding this thing with, you know, and it's cash flowing and it's solid and it's we like it still, yes, there might be higher and better uses of that capital that we could go and deploy it elsewhere. But when we turn around and give you a bunch of money, we also give you a bunch of problems, which is now you have to turn around and figure out what to do with it. And right. if it makes sense just to continue holding that asset, we'd prefer to do that just indefinitely, like right. just buy and hold it forever. Because it's a de-risked investment at that point. We've got our initial investment capital back. It's still cash flowing. It's still generating. Now we don't have the headache of like the tax implications or having to go and rush to find the next deal to deploy that capital in so that inflation doesn't just burn up all our money. Mm-hmm. So that's our approach to it.
So when somebody is investing in one of these projects, are they investing in the project itself, or are they investing in Invictus Capital as a whole?
It's project by project. And so there's two ways that you can do this. There's what's called single asset syndication, which is if you go on our website and you look at all those deals, like each one of those was presented in its individual nature to investors and said, hey, do you want to invest in Duluth? Do you want to invest in Grand? And they get to see the numbers, they get to see the business plan and all that stuff. There's another way, which is called the fund, right? And like, I think people are more familiar with the fund model, which is, you know, put some money into this thing and maybe we're raising $5 million. And the idea is that we're going to go deploy that $5 million across 3 to 4 to 5 different assets, a certain type, a certain quality, a certain yield. And then investors don't necessarily get any say in which deal or which buildings those are being deployed into. They're investing largely into the macro thesis, but right. people aren't investing into Invictus Capital. They're investing into the LLC that owns the individual building.
Gotcha. What can go wrong?
A lot.
Yeah.
A lot. So, I mean, the thing is like, it's real estate, but really it's a business. right? Yep. Like each one of these things is an individual business. You have to go in there and maximize revenues, decrease operational expenses. And whenever you get into that world, operational expertise matters, right? It's just what it is. So the number one risk that you're going to run into is operators. Can they do what they say? Are they trustworthy? Like I say, I talk a big game, right? But at the end of the day, like if I turn out to be a crook or a fraud, like then like numbers don't lie, but I can make them say whatever I want. So like the performer right. no longer matters, right? And maybe I'm not a crook. Maybe I'm just delusional and I think I can do this, but I actually get into the field and now I'm like, oh, I can't actually, I thought I could do this, but it is really hard, right?
Yeah.
There's always operational risk. That's the biggest one. There's macroeconomic risk. I mean, investing is dangerous. It's risky inherently.
And well, luckily, this isn't your first project, so yeah. you at least have a track record.
Exactly. And the thing for us is that, you know, I started in 2012, 2013, buying my own assets, and I did that until 2019. That's mm-hmm. 2019 is when we took in our first retail investment. And I firmly believe in this industry that you need to pay your tuition at the School of Hard Knocks with your own dime before yep. you go get money from other people. Because for me, like, I remember the value of a dollar. Like I remember having to do mental calculus, and I'm not good at this. So be doing the math between like, should I fill up my van / my home with gas, or should I go get food? Like,
right.
When those are your choices, and you're like, I got $10.
Yeah, what should I fill?
Yeah, I got to stretch it. Do I fill myself? Do I fill the car?
Right. Or the pothole.
Yeah, or the pothole. And like money is like for me, it's still a trigger. It's still a thing where I look at it and I'm like, I'm super cheap. I'm so cheap. My girlfriend like gives me so much. Everybody gives me a lot of crap. Like I'm really, really cheap.
Yeah.
Because it pains me to spend money. But it's also a good attribute in the sense of like working with investors, because when they give us money, I don't really see the money. I see the time and the energy that they exchanged to get that money. And right. it's like $50,000 for most people is a lot of money.
That's a right? lot
like,
of work.
It's a lot of work that went into that. Mm-hmm. So I look at that and I'm like, this is a really important sacred trust that's been formed here. Like, I don't want this money unless I'm really, really certain that I can do right by it.
So have there ever been any projects that you've failed on?
No, nothing that's failed, but we have things that have not gone to plan. So like earlier I said, like I'm a guy that just believes like if I don't give up, I've never failed. Like if I yeah. just keep moving forward, like I fail my way to success. And we have had, you know, we closed a deal in January of 2020 that was a heavy value add. And what that meant was there was a lot of work to be done on this deal. We needed to get in there. We needed to move out literally all the tenants because it was real rough. It was really, really rough. And then we had to do all these renovations in the building, right? That became very difficult when 3 months later, there's an eviction moratorium. Suddenly the cost of like logistics and supplies and labor is like short supply. Everything's super expensive. We're like, all right, our performer.
Lumber quadruples.
Yeah. Suddenly things are like looking a little bit dubious. So like, that's an example of like the plan did not go to plan. But thankfully, like it wasn't a failure in the sense that we come into each deal really well capitalized with a lot of reserves mm-hmm. because we're the types of guys that assume like the world is always like on the precipice of ending.
Right.
So let's just try like the best way to prepare for that. Like to your point earlier, like the market's irrationality can outlast your solvency. Like our thesis is like, well, if that's true. But the only thing that we can do as a result is try and be really, really solvent.
Yep.
I wanted to know, are your retail investors able to like keep their money growing inside the investment?
Like, so when there's like a cash flow distribution, let's say quarterly, or we do a refinance and return capital, you're asking, can they keep it in the deal?
Yeah. Can they just keep rolling it into a greater, larger stake?
No.
No. Okay.
No. So we raise all the capital and like ownership stakes and like shares of the company is all divvied up at the beginning. Right. And so you're not, everybody's share would be increasing pro rata. So it wouldn't really work anyway.
Right.
So it does create, so here's the thing. Here's what's really cool about real estate is like there's a lot of tax benefits to it. Right. And as being a limited partner in these deals, you still get to benefit from the tax benefits, which is the depreciation. So what ends up happening,
I love depreciation.
I love it. It's so good, yeah. Right? And most people don't understand it. And we started talking about taxes and people have already tuned out. But hey, like right. I promise we're going to come back to spaceships and rocket ships
yes.
a little bit later. Right? But taxes, like, this is important because what we do is what's called a cost segregation study with accelerated depreciation. Okay, all these fancy words. What it really means is that the cash flow that you're receiving throughout the life of the deal is pretty much, and I'm not your tax advisor, and I don't pretend to be one on TV either, so like, talk to your guy or gal before, when you're getting tax advice. But generally, what we've seen with our investors is that all the cash flow that you're going to be getting throughout the life of the deal is going to be completely wiped out by the depreciation and the passive losses. Now, when we go to sell the building, there is depreciation recapture. That's a different problem for a different day. But generally, what this means is more money stays in your pocket longer, right? So you just get to kick the tax can really far down the road, which is really important. The second part is the cash out refinance, which I was talking about before, where we go add the value, then we recapitalize it with a new piece of debt. That's a tax-free event. So you're just receiving your initial capital back. So if you put $50,000 in and we do the refinance, and let's say we return 50% of your capital, that means you get $25,000 that you can go redeploy in another deal. It was tax-free. Like, you don't have to pay taxes on that. It's awesome. What's really important in that is that though we return your capital, your ownership stake in the deal is not being diluted.
Oh, that was my question there. Okay. So you're not cashing this out at that point.
And again, this is different for different operators. This is how we do it.
You're just getting your investment back.
Exactly. But you're still in the deal. You still own and you're still getting cash flow, right?
Oh, wow.
So this is how we do the deal. Because again, like, our families are in these deals with us. We don't want to buy them out. We're like, no, we want you to stay in the deal. Like, you, this is good. It's a good thing for everybody.
That is awesome.
And as the loan gets paid down, the payout gets increases, I'm assuming?
Yeah. So your return is going to be, you know, depending on your ownership stake, right? And as the deal goes on, what ends up happening, you have principal pay down, which is awesome. But the deal starts to be like, start to operate more efficiently as time goes on as well. It tends to be just like higher and higher cash flows as time goes on through that.
Especially after you fixed everything that can break.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, like, our expense ratio might have been around 45%. Now it's like 38%. So it's like, oh, more cash flow. Perfect.
So how are the Twin Cities as far as like a rental area?
We love the Twin Cities, but again, I'm biased. So I'll leave with some of the hair on the dog. St. Paul initiated rent control last year. Like, and that sucks. Like, that makes it a lot harder to operate. But for us, the Twin Cities are a fantastic market, because what a lot of people don't realize about us is that we have more Fortune 500 companies per capita than any other city in the country. So like, everybody, for whatever reason, like, these Fortune 500 companies all want to be in the frozen north. And it's awesome. Like, we have a really high quality of life. We're like the third fittest city in the country. And maybe most importantly, when it comes to like the economic situation, is that we have a really high median income, around $70,000-$75,000, and a really low cost of living. So our affordability index in terms of what people can afford is massive. So usually what people budget for rent or for cost of living, like in a home, right, is about 30% of your budget. So roughly 30% of your income should go towards your housing. In our market, people are only spending about 22-21%. So it's like, there's still a lot of room to absorb rent growth. And like, so it just signals that it's not like a overvalued market where people are just getting touched, right? So we love it for all those reasons. It is harder to operate from a regulatory standpoint than it would be if we were in Texas and it's, you know, a red state where it's like, yeah, go do what you want. Like, not in peace, like, have fun. Like, here it's a little bit different, right? And that can turn people off for sure, but that's also our opportunity. And that's where we find our unique edge, is this is our backyard. And we know the city council, we know the mayor, we know how to operate within it. And there's a lot of opportunities to be found as a result.
That's something else. Oh man.
That's amazing.
Okay. Well, now I got some homework to do.
Yeah. Also, we have really bad sports teams. So there you go. Poor Vikings.
Aren't you the home of the Juicy Lucy too?
We are.
I was going to say, how can you be fit with those?
Maybe I should have left that.
What the hell is the Juicy Lucy?
It's a hamburger that has the cheese stuffed in the middle of it in a pocket.
Injected molten cheese.
I'm in. Sign me up.
I haven't made one of those for you yet, Dan.
No, sign me up.
I mean, if you guys find yourself in the Twin Cities, we'll take a Juicy Lucy tour.
Oh, fuck yeah. I once made the mistake of I used to grind my own bacon to mix into my hamburger meat. And I tried making a Juicy Lucy with that, but then it just ended up filling up with bacon grease. And I bit into it and just scalded everything.
We went to this this local burger joint this last week for an investor thank you party, because we just closed on a deal like 2 weeks ago. So we had a party. And this place has like one of the best, I think it's ranked the best hamburger in Minneapolis. So it's really, really, really good. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, you know, dressed nicely because, you know, we shouldn't look like a slouch, I guess, when
right. investors.
like, hey, trust us with your money. Remember, over here in the future. And I bite into the burger and like scalding cheese just goes everywhere. I'm like,
oh,
this is my life.
Oh God, that's hilarious. Hopefully it was an expensive suit.
It was, unfortunately. It's all right. These are first world problems for sure.
Oh, he's Sergio Burger
Mac jacket. This guy. And then a space car.
I think we're running out of time, Dan.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. Oh man, this is a fun conversation. Anthony, do you want to tell people where they can find out more if they want to learn more about Invictus Capital or more about your other projects?
Yeah, I'll tell you what. I'll give you guys some homework here.
Yes.
I mean, you guys want to learn about what we do on the real estate side, go to InvictusMultifamily.com. There's a ton of resources there. The podcast is Multifamily Investing Made Simple. But if you want, like we mentioned before, if you want a copy of the book, Passive Investing Made Simple, which is just breaks down everything that we already talked about here, because I know that this investment vehicle is probably not on the radar of most investors. Mm-hmm. Like, I talked to a lot of investors, like, I've never heard of this. So if you want to learn about it, just shoot me an email, anthony@invictusmultifamily.com. Say, hey, I heard you on the podcast. Loved everything except for the rocket car part. That was weird. But I want a free book. If you send me that message or a message of that sort, then I'll send you a free book.
They don't have to criticize us. Yeah. I would like to point that out.
No. No, in fact, if you guys go leave a review, that's how you get the book, right?
Yeah, there you go.
Go leave these guys a review. Go thank them for the effort.
They're gonna be reviewing our hamburger choices.
They're gonna be like, Juicy Lucy meats for life.
Yeah, to learn how to make a bacon burger from the show about investing.
Otherwise, I'm on social medias everywhere. So if you guys just want to come DM.
Are you on the Twitter or?
I'm on the Twitter. I'm on the Facebook, the LinkedIn, the Instagram, all the places. So Anthony, if you just Google Anthony Vecino, I think I'm not the only one, but I'm definitely the tallest.
The one with the good photos, right?
So I think that helps me rank on Google.
We have an Instagram account, but I have not been able to figure out how to do anything with it. I think it's designed to be operated from your phone. The desktop version does not work.
Yep. I exactly. So old.
Thank you so much, Anthony, for stopping by and joining us. This is a fun conversation and informational too. I actually learned quite a bit.
Enlightening. Yes.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
All right, Dan, you want to take us home?
Yeah, that was a really, really awesome time. I really do appreciate you stopping by, Anthony. Thank you. Folks, we'll be back at you soon. Can't stay here, but hey, you don't have to go home. Until next time, happy trades.
Bye. Thanks for joining us. You can find us off air at twobullsinachinashop.com. That's the number 2bullsinachinashop.com. Make sure you check us out. Download us on any streaming network. Blah, 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 blah. You know what to do. Rate, subscribe.
Two Bulls in a China Shop is an entertainment program, and all thoughts and opinions expressed in the show belong to the hosts and not of any company. They are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security or investment product. It is only intended to provide entertainment about stocks and the financial industry of trading. If you make trades based on what you hear in this show, you assume all risks for those trades.